Welcome to Weird Stuff Happens in Canada.
I'm Emily.
No.
You're Emily.
You.
I'm Britt.
Honestly.
And this is Weird Stuff Happens in Canada.
I was trying to be professional, and then you just really derailed the whole thing
with your shenanigans. You left a pause for me to fill in, and I filled
it in. Yeah, you were supposed to say your own name.
Content.
Oh my God. This is Weird Stuff Happens in Canada. It's a podcast about Canada.
And the weird stuff that happens in it.
And honestly, I'm really sorry for the person I've chosen to bring on this adventure with me.
It's because you live with me. You can't get away.
It's true.
Here we are. Here we are in our professional podcasting suite with a cat tree and some flowers. And this pineapple made of gold.
Yep. You should probably stop just naming things you can see.
And this picture of Frida Kahlo. And
Please stop.
Some chickens.
Today, we're going to talk about inventors.
Canadian inventors.
Because Canada loves to invent stuff.
Yep. It's because it's so cold here.
What else are we supposed to do?
Just got to stay inside and invent some stuff. It's like that time that my heaters didn't work, and so I invented a way to, like, self-insulate my bed. Let's not talk about that.
did you just claim to have invented blankets?
Nope. Moving on. Emily, what Canadian inventor have you learned about in the last 12 minutes?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I have decided to talk about one of Canada's most prolific inventors.
More than Bell? He wasn't Canadian.
Didn't he have, like, a Canadian connection?
He had some kind of Canadian connection. That's why our telephone company is called Bell, I'm assuming.
Just like Roger.
That's named after Ted Rogers.
Yeah, the inventor.
Was he more prolific than Frederick Banting? I only know one thing he invented, so maybe he wasn't prolific at all.
Well, I'm going to talk today about someone who was definitely prolific.
Mm-hmm.
And that was George Klein.
Never heard of him.
Of course you haven't. Because Canada doesn't care about getting credit for stuff.
That's true.
But he invented so many things.
Oh my God, tell me all about it. I want to know all of the things.
Well, it's 1904. George Klein was born in Hamilton, Ontario.
I've been there. It's terrible.
Yeah, it's terrible. His father owned a jewelry store and a watch factory.
Like a jewelry store front for a watch factory back?
I mean, like, I don't think the watch factory was illegal.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
I think
gotcha,
it was just a straight up,
like, above board watch factory.
Yeah.
Okay.
So little Georgie Klein, he spent his spare time hanging out at the jewelry store, watching the watch factory watchers.
Who watches the watch factory?
He really liked that at the watch factory, he could see both the artistic work being done by the gold and silversmiths and the detailed mechanics of the watch building.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet.
And he referred to it as the gymnasium of creativity.
Aw, what a nerd.
Yeah. Oh, he's the biggest nerd.
Yay! I love him.
So, George Klein was not a great student, but he was really good at building stuff.
Good.
And so, because it was the 1920s, they were like, hey, you're good at building stuff. You get a scholarship to U of T.
Yay!
So he went to the University of Toronto. He studied applied science and engineering.
I wish it was still like that.
Right?
Yeah. But not for me.
We're not good at building stuff.
I'm like book smart. But there are people who are really good at building stuff who are not book smart, who should still go to university.
Yeah, but we're book smart, so the system is working for us.
Yeah, you're right. I take it back. Edit it out.
So in 1928, George Klein graduated from U of T with a bachelor's degree in applied science. And he never did a postgrad degree because it was the 20s. And why would you?
Why would you ever need to
do that? Because in 1929, he was hired by the National Research Council of Canada.
Yay.
Honestly, your enthusiasm is like not genuine. And I can tell.
Yeah.
You're just not excited because you don't know enough about the National Research Council.
Tell
it
me.
Is the primary research and technology organization for the government of Canada.
What do they make?
Well,
what they, do they do?
They
do they make cars? Do they make flying cars? Do they make jetpacks? Now I'm excited.
Okay.
So the National Research Council of Canada makes jetpacks.
No, we did not claim that. We never said that.
Steam-powered flying airships.
That is not true. The NRC was established in 1916 because it was wartime.
Yep.
And everything was going wrong.
Yeah.
And they were like, guys, fix it.
They're like, can you please build something to fix the war?
Yeah.
And the scientists were like, no.
No,
we can't.
But after the war, they were like, we should probably keep building stuff. That's why cool. They hired George Klein.
George Klein is there. He's going to build all the stuff, right, Sally?
Yeah. So, George Klein spent 40 years at the National Research Council.
That's like his whole life.
It's a really friggin' long time.
I know, because at that time you only lived to be like 45, so.
Okay, it wasn't that bad. But he invented so many things.
Like what?
Like
jetpacks.
No. He designed the first wind tunnels at the NRC.
What do those do?
A wind tunnel is like you use it to
test cars, flying cars, steam-powered airships.
I was going to say you use it to test airplanes.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And you could use it to test cars, I guess.
Yeah.
It's about resistance and
Yeah.
And
so he was he the first person to ever build wind tunnels?
No, he just built them at the NRC the first time.
Gotcha.
He invented plastic-coated skis for aircraft so they could land on snowy ground.
Oh, that's cool. Like on helicopters.
Yeah, because he loved cross-country skiing.
What a nerd. Yeah.
This led to the development of a tracked snowmobile called the Weasel.
Okay.
Which ended up being manufactured by the U.S. Army in World War II and used to carry troops across snow and ice. But also proved useful in the tropics.
How? What?
Because in a lot of cases, sand acts the same as snow.
Oh.
So they were able to, like, adapt it to the tropics.
That's cool.
And Klein's expertise on the mechanics of snow was legendary. I'm sure you've heard of it.
Mm, yeah. Well,
it led to him inventing an international system for classifying the ground cover of snow.
Wow.
I wrote that down. It sounds like nonsense now. But we'll get to the good stuff. These are just small potatoes.
Oh, okay. These are still pretty good potatoes.
World War II happens.
Okay.
And they're like, guys, we gotta get serious.
God, just as a sidebar, it would be so shitty to have to live through World War I and also World War II.
Yeah.
Like,
dude, I know.
You're like, again? Yeah. And worse?
And worse.
Ugh. Okay, continue.
So, in World War II, he designed aiming systems for artillery and naval anti-submarine mortars.
Okay. That's probably pretty useful.
Probably.
Yeah.
Now it starts to get good. In 1944/1945, Klein was the chief engineer and mechanical designer for the Zero Energy Experiment Pile.
I don't know what that means.
Well, it's
but
also,
I'm excited about
it's
it.
It's also known as ZEEP.
Still don't know what that means, but I'm more excited.
It was the first nuclear reactor to operate outside of the U.S.
Ooh, is that a good thing?
Well, you know, he did it, and I feel like nuclear power is going to be one of those things that was important in the evolution of renewable energy.
Right.
It wasn't perfect.
Nope.
At all.
Where did he build it?
It was like in Ontario somewhere. There's like a museum maybe, or a plaque, or statue. I don't know.
A George Klein statue like in skis? I'm skiing!
Like probably not.
This is my true love! And he's holding a watch?
No.
Okay.
He's holding a watch. It's the details that are important. In this time, while he was designing a friggin' nuclear reactor, he also developed the first microsurgical staple gun to successfully suture blood vessels.
Whoa, that's crazy.
Basically, George Klein was so smart. and just loved inventing stuff.
And, like, kind of, like, inventing things across the board.
And it's really, I think the thing that links all of his inventions is that he would see a need for something.
Yeah.
And then be like, well, here, I made this thing to fix that need.
Yeah. And they're like, great.
Cool.
Awesome.
Which feeds into the next thing he invented, which arguably might be the most famous thing that he invented.
Okay.
So, in World War II,
okay,
many more people were surviving serious spinal cord injuries than they had in World War I.
Right.
Because of the invention of a little something called penicillin.
Right.
George Klein had nothing to do with penicillin.
No, he did not.
But there was like 80 to 90% of people who had spinal cord injuries were now surviving.
Wow.
And
wow.
So,
that's a lot.
Yeah. And
yeah.
Like people that would have died before.
Yeah.
And so they were all like, we're here. I was going to try to make a sort of a rhyme, but I couldn't.
We're alive, but our spines are sore. Please help our spines.
Please help our spines. That's really good. So one survivor was a Canadian officer named John Council, who was shot in the back at Dieppe, and he became a paraplegic. So back in Canada after the war, Council began using a manual wheelchair, but he quickly realized that he really needed more independence, mm-hmm. and that tons of people like him, they were... When you are in a manual wheelchair, you rely so heavily on other people.
Yeah.
And it becomes really, really tough. So he requested that the NRC build him a new kind of wheelchair.
Oh my God, I'm so excited about this.
So
invention.
They were like, hey, Georgie.
Yeah.
Can you
figure this out? You do everything great already. Please just do this.
Yeah.
Please.
So he was like, okay, yeah, I can probably handle it. And he ended up inventing a whole bunch of separate things, including a joystick, a tighter turning system, a system for driving that had separate wheel drives, and all of these things combined to be the first electric wheelchair.
Yay! That's a great invention.
Yeah, and it was so successful in Canada that there was immediately this huge international demand, because once people saw all these Canadian war veterans zipping around in their electric wheelchairs, they were like,
can I?
Excuse me.
Me, please.
Yeah. So this led to Canada in our token spirit of giving. The Canadian government gave Klein's original prototype to the American Department of Veterans Affairs with patent-free rights to encourage production.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so nice,
yeah.
Right? The American government eventually, in like 2004 or something, gave the prototype back so that we could put it in a museum somewhere.
Oh, nice. Also, just like as a sidebar again, how fucking terrible accessibility would have been in the 1940s.
Oh,
like
just
how
the worst.
Bad it is now. Like, we still need to get our shit together on that. But just how fucking bad it would be in the 1940s.
Yeah. Ugh. So terrible.
Thank God for George Klein.
But his career wasn't over.
Oh my gosh.
So, in the 1950s, he invented something called STEM, which stands for storable.
Wait, let me guess. Storable.
You will never guess this in a million years.
Technology.
No.
Storable toadstools eat men. That's what he invented.
Yeah, that's what he invented. No. STEM stands for storable tubular extendable member.
Ooh. It's not a sex thing.
It is not a sex thing.
Okay.
Yet.
Ooh.
No, it was this antenna that was rolled into a flat reel, which could be unfolded on command.
Okay.
So it was basically like an automatically unfurling antenna.
Still sounds like a sex thing.
But part of the importance of it was that it rolled into like a reel.
Okay.
So instead of having it just be long pieces, they were like,
oh,
you
bendy.
Could, yeah, you could store it in a reel. And everyone was like, you know where we need that?
Sex.
Space. No, space.
Yeah, for sure. Because at space, you have such little space.
Well, you have infinite space.
But inside the capsule is such a little space. So yeah. You're like, we gotta roll everything up teeny tiny.
Yeah. So, in 1962, STEM was first used in space on a Canadian mission, and then NASA was like, guys, can we have that? And we were like, yeah, sure.
Oh my god. I mean, like, America tried to recruit George Klein, like, multiple times. Oh,
and like, he was like, I like skiing. Do you guys have cross-country skiing?
Yeah, he's like, in Canada, there's enough snow for me to ski 8 months out of the year.
Yeah, because he lived in Ottawa, where it's always,
yeah,
as cold as death.
I like skiing. So now,
no skiing. He likes skiing. That's what
I
sang.
Oh. But I laughed as I said it.
So NASA really liked STEM because it could increase the size of a satellite antennae from a few meters to over 40 meters.
Oh my god!
Because in space, no one can stop your antennae from unfurling.
In space, we use the metric system.
Do they use the metric system in space?
I assume they... Well, I don't know if NASA does, but everyone in the world...
They better use it in space. They're not going to be like, oh, it's 4 miles from here. And then Russia's going to be like, I hate you.
This International Space Station's like, get out of America!
So, 1969.
Okay.
Klein is like, guys, I've worked here for 40 years.
Yeah.
I'm going to retire.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, cool, cool, cool. We're on board with that. But then, in the 1970s.
Oh my god, they brought him back.
Well, NASA needed a remote-controlled robotic arm to do some stuff in space.
Oh my god.
And they were like, you know who we should get to build this arm?
Yeah.
Canada. So they awarded the contract to a small group of Canadian high-tech companies, including the company that at the time was manufacturing the antenna that George Klein had invented.
The STEM antenna.
And the project was all going to be managed by the National Research Council. So they were like, ring, ring. Hi, George.
Hi, I just got in from a night of skiing out in the cross country landscape.
Great. Can you come back to work?
I guess.
Yeah, that is exactly what happened. That was a transcript you just heard. I mean, a recording. I'm out of control. So he came out of retirement to act as a consultant because of his expertise in the industrial gearing system.
Yeah, yeah.
His
expertise in every system.
In every system. So the result of the project was a little something you may have heard of called the Canadarm.
The Canadarm?
You've never heard of the Canadarm?
No, I've heard of... I always call it the Canada arm. I didn't know they had mushed it.
Of course they mushed it! You were calling it the Canada arm?
Yeah, Canada arm.
No, Canadarm.
Canadarm's way better. I'm not saying I was right.
Oh my god! I can't with you.
God, I'm finding out something new every time we do one of these.
So the Canadarm, yeah, as literally everyone calls it, has been used in over 50 space missions since the 1970s, and it still is being used today. They've built like 5 kind of versions of it, but they're all based on
his original design.
I don't know if it was his design. I don't want to say that if that's not true.
His design. He built it with his 2 hands in the remote Canadian wilderness with only the pieces of a watch.
I don't think that's true.
Literally, as we're talking about this, the cat is biting me the entire time.
So George Klein.
Yes.
He died in 1992.
No! Well, he didn't invent a way to live forever?
He was 88 years old.
Okay, that's pretty old.
And he had invented literally a million things.
Yeah, he did his job.
And one time in an interview, they were like, you're so amazing, you're so prolific, like, why did you do this? And he was like, oh, being in the lab was really fun.
Oh my god. He just loved what he did.
He just loved it.
Did he ever get married? That's not really important.
It's not. And I don't have it written in my notes. So, like, probably. He probably had, like, a cross-country skiing wife and, like, babies. Like, that's what I hope. And they probably just skied all around.
Yep. What a great life he had. And he helped so many people.
And he helped so many people.
Yeah.
And that's the story of Canada's greatest inventor.
Greatest inventor?
Yes.
Oh, you're going there.
I'm going there.
Well, my inventor might not be that prolific. Sally, stop.
Our cat has literally never been more mad at Britt than she is at this moment.
I'm trying to read my story.
She's just biting her arm.
I'm trying to read my story. Okay, my inventor might not be as prolific as George Klein, but he might have invented the most Canadian of inventions.
Is it the loony?
No.
Is it a loon?
No.
Is it a beaver?
No.
He didn't invent... Is it a Mountie?
No.
Is it those Mountie pants?
No, but that's a really Canadian invention. It is the infamous goalie mask.
I've seen a Heritage Minute about this!
So, you and other Canadians may or may not have seen a Heritage Minute about it. If you are not Canadian or are new to Canada, there was a thing in the maybe 90s that was like the Canadian Heritage Minute, and they used these very famous moments from Canada in which famous historic things happened, and they would reenact it.
Can I tell you my favorite one?
Yes, please.
Well, all of them are my favorite.
Obviously. But every Canadian of a certain age knows these by heart.
I think my favorite would have to be Laura Secord.
That was a good one.
When she's lying and she's like passed out on the hill.
Yes.
And then an Aboriginal person comes and she looks up and she's like, "Take me to Fitzgibbon."
That's a really good one.
That's my favorite part.
That's a really good one. So there is one about the invention of the goalie mask, but what you might not have seen in that Heritage Minute, and I did rewatch it because they're on YouTube to make sure I was getting the pronunciation of his name right. This goes a little bit deeper than that. So, in the years leading up to World War I and the formation of the NHL in 1917, most hockey players would kind of take it easy with their shots on goal. Like, it was kind of this unspoken rule that you wouldn't really nail it into the net.
Because it was a live person?
Because there was an actual person standing there with
sure.
No stuff on their face.
Were they wearing a helmet?
No, they didn't wear anything. They just had like body pads on. Yeah. So, by the end of World War II, the game really started to pick up as like inventions and...
Is it because men didn't have feelings anymore?
Yeah, that's exactly why. They were like, I don't care about that guy's face anymore. I'm going to shoot as hard as I want because I'm a man and that's what men do. No. Also, this is probably a good moment to say, sorry, Jake. Continuing.
I'm not sorry.
So, little known fact, the very first time a goalie-esque mask was worn was by another Canadian.
Whoa.
Named Elizabeth Graham.
That sounds like a lady name.
It is a lady.
Whoa.
She played for women's hockey for the University of Queen's University in Kingston. That's what it's called. But it was a metal fencing mask, so she was just trying to protect her teeth, and so she was like, well, this'll do.
She was like, ladies need teeth to get dudes.
Yeah, they do. And they need dudes to have a life in 1927.
Yeah.
So, following that, in 1930, a crude leather version of the mask was worn by this guy named Clint Benedict. He played for the Montreal Maroons. But it was like an American football nose guard.
Okay.
And so he had broken his nose and he just like put it on to protect his nose.
So it would do basically nothing.
No. It wasn't really a mask.
Cool.
And once his nose was fixed, he was like, see you later. Never wore it again. In the 1936 Winter Olympics in Germany, a goaltender representing Japan named Taiji Honma, he wore basically like a baseball catcher mask because he had these big round glasses that he had to protect. And he was like, no, I'm glasses. So he wore it in the Olympics, but he played like two games in the Olympics and that was kind of the end of his career.
Sure.
But it wasn't until 1959 that a goaltender wore a mask full time. That man's name was Jacques Plante. Jacques Plante, born January 15th, 1929.
Why are you so mad at him?
I love him. He has the cutest childhood. Prepare yourself.
Tell me.
He was born in Mauricie, Quebec, the first of 11 children.
That's too many.
In 1932, so he was 3 years old, he began to play hockey, skateless with a tennis ball, and with a hockey stick carved from a tree root that his dad made him. At five, he fell off a ladder and broke his hand, and it never healed properly, but it gave him kind of a distinct playing style later in life, which would come into play as to, like, other in other ways he kind of furthered the game of hockey for goaltenders. He suffered
weird
because of like the way he had to like hold the stick and stuff.
Got it.
So he suffered really badly from asthma. So he kind of gravitated towards playing goalie because you did less skating.
So he was lazy. That's what you're telling me.
Yeah, exactly. So his pops made his first goalie pads from potato sacks that he stuffed with stuff. And because it was so cold in Quebec in the winter, his mom taught him how to knit his own toques. And that led to like his signature look because he kept that up, that hobby, his whole life of knitting and embroidering his own toques.
What?
So like all of his like hockey pictures, it's like him and his goalie stuff. He's like all tough, but he's wearing like a little toque on top of his head.
Oh my god!
That he made himself.
That's so cute.
Because he's such a sweetheart. So his first foray into organized hockey was at age 12. At age 14, he played for the local factory team because his dad worked at the factory. And his dad was like, you know that they get paid to play. And he was like, what? And he's like, I want to get paid. And he was so good that the factory manager didn't want to lose their only good goalie. So they're like, sure, we'll pay you. So they paid him like factory wages to play goaltender for the factory team. He was 14 years old. And he got various offers from other teams like in Europe and in the States to come play professionally, but his parents really wanted him to finish school, so he rejected all his offers and he graduated with honors in 1947.
Good for him.
1947 was also the beginning of his professional career. He was asked to join the Quebec Citadels, which is kind of like I don't know what the equivalent to the OHL is in Quebec, but it was like not
the QHL.
Like, I guess it's like a minor league. This was around the time he invented a very unique playing style. So he started to play the defense on his team kind of sucked. So he started to play outside the crease, which goalies never did at the time. You just have to like stay in your crease, let the puck come to you, and you like never left the net because the coaches.
How are you supposed to defend it if you're not there?
That's what the coaches were like. Don't leave. They'll shoot on the open net. But he was like, if I maintain control of the puck, like no one can shoot on me. So now you see goalies do that all the time. They leave and they kind of like curve the puck around and then they shoot it back out to like their team. So he was the first person to do this and he really developed that kind of like unique goaltending style. And fans really loved it because it was like very thrilling to like see the goaltender like leave the net.
Right.
I remember like watching hockey as a kid and being like, don't go. Don't leave. I get really anxious when they like leave the net. So this is now standard practice. So in 1953, he was called up to play for the Montreal Canadiens, and he got into a bit of trouble at this time because he wouldn't stop wearing his toques, and they weren't regulation.
Jacques,
But by 1954, he was so good that he became their starting goaltender, so like within a year, which is crazy.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
That's faster than...
So over the next five seasons, the Canadiens would win 5 consecutive Stanley Cups.
Whoa, that's exactly. So many.
However, during this same time, Plante was undergoing a number of kind of serious health issues. So his asthma was getting really bad. He had really severe and chronic bronchitis for a number of those years. He had a really severe sinusitis operation. And he got a really severe concussion that took him out of 3 playoff games in the 1958-59 season, which leads us to a very fateful night. So at the time, like in the early ages of hockey, it was like really when they would shoot on net as like the game of hockey began to pick up post-World War II, were in severe danger of death or dismemberment, sure. essentially. There's, like, a quote from this one guy. He's a Hall of Fame goaltender, Glenn Hall. And he was, like, essentially it was just, like, 60 minutes of hell because you were just scared the whole time. And he said that before every game he would, like, vomit because he was just, like, preparing himself mentally to, like, go out there. But he played for 502 consecutive regular season games without facial protection, this guy,
Glenn Hall. That's too many.
So just imagine, like, putting yourself through that. So Jacques Plante was like, there's got to be a better way. And on the Montreal Canadiens at the time, like, Maurice Richard was playing.
Ah, the Rocket.
Exactly. And so all these guys who had, like, the strongest shooting arms, I don't know what it's called, in, like, the whole league. And so Jacques Plante was like, there has to be a better way. We have to, like, protect ourselves. And also at the time, there was no backup goalies. Most teams just had one goaltender, and that was
that
it.
That is a bad idea.
Right? And so they were saying, like, there were six teams in the league at the time, and each, like, at each arena, there was, like, a home goalie, which was essentially, like, a beer league guy that would just, like, be there in case the goalie couldn't play.
Right.
But they were, like, not very good. Mm-hmm. So you always wanted your goalie to be okay. So he convinced his coach to let him wear this, like, crude mask that he got this guy to make for him during practice, because he was like, we have, like, the best shooters in the league.
Yeah.
Like,
might as well not get injured from them shooting on me.
Yeah, at a practice. So his coach was like, yeah, that makes sense. So he let him wear it during practice. And so Plante also had a really bad habit of fouling out his opponents. So he would, like, trip people and, like, slash them.
Honestly, how is this guy allowed to play hockey?
He's just a little rapscallion.
He's got terrible asthma and he's always tripping people.
But he's also, like, the best goalie in the entire league. And they won 5 Stanley Cups with him as only goaltender. So he's amazing. So there was one guy in particular, New York Rangers right wing Andy Bathgate, who they kind of had, like, a back and forth vendetta against each other because Plante would always, like, slash at him. So on this fateful night, November 1st, 1959, what was just another game turned into a landmark moment of hockey history. Excuse me. So, Andy Bathgate, pretty pissed off, decided he was going to get even with Jacques Plante. So he did a shot that they were saying, it was like, they call it a backhand shot, which is similar to, in baseball, like a knuckleball. So it kind of comes from, like, a weird angle. So he did that on purpose, and he aimed it for Plante's face. Oof. On purpose. And most of the time, again, as this, like, unspoken rule, they would aim for, like, the chest down.
Mm-hmm.
But he aimed it for his head because he was pissed off. And so it hit him right in the face because he couldn't get out of the way or move to block it. And it hit him in the nose, but also, like, from his nose down to his lip, and sliced his face open. And they described it as that his face looked like mashed potato covered in ketchup.
Ew.
So he, like, collapsed onto the ice, and there's just, like, blood everywhere. And there was the in-house goalie, like, was there, and he saw it, and he was like, well, shit, gotta go get, like, suited up.
Yeah.
So he was in back for, like, 20 minutes getting his face stitched up. And there was this very famous Montreal Gazette and NHL reporter that was there. And he was like, this is a quote from him. He was like, he had been struck in the face and it opened a cut from the corner of his mouth all the way through his nostril. Try and imagine that, the pain he was going through. I rushed down to the dressing room and there was Plante looking in the mirror and separating the cut and looking at it. Pretty ugly, he said to me. I said, yeah, well, you had a good start, Jacques.
Oh, God.
So it's a 21-minute delay. Everyone's getting, like, anxious.
Mm-hmm.
Jacques Plante is, like, the coach is trying to get him to go out because he doesn't want to lose the game with this shitty other goaltender.
Yeah.
So he's, like, Jacques Plante is, like, the only way I'm going back out there is if you let me wear my practice mask. And the coach was like, no, fuck no. Like, nobody at the time would wear it. And it was considered to be kind of
emasculating to wear it because it was, you know, showing a sign of weakness. And so he refused to go out unless the guy would let him wear it. And finally the coach relented and let him wear it. And so he came out and everyone, there was like 15,000 people there and they were all just like stunned. Like no one could believe that they were seeing this like weird, and it was like a weird looking mask too. It was like kind of horrifying. It looks a lot like the like Jason from Friday the 13th mask.
Oh, I remember the Heritage Minute.
Yeah, you do. So everyone was like, is it going to work? Like, will he be able to play with it on? Because the real fear was that you couldn't see through the mask. That's why a lot of goalies refused to wear them, because they thought it would, like, kind of shield their vision. But they defeated the Rangers 3-1, and it was the beginning of a 10-0 unbeaten streak, and Plante was in goal for all 11 games.
Whoa!
And he kept wearing the mask. And so there was one game after that 11-game streak that the coach tried to convinced him to stop wearing the mask, and they lost terribly, and Plante never played without a mask again. So, and that was a season where he led the Canadiens to an unprecedented fifth consecutive Stanley Cup.
Wow, wow, wow.
Dun-da-da-da! So, and the invention of the hockey mask was born. And after that, people, because he was like the best goalie in the league, so people started wearing them more and more. And I think they said the last person to play without wearing a mask was like 1974 or so. But after a while, people just started realizing that it was just better.
Don't be a dumb, dumb idiot.
Yeah.
Wear a mask so and you don't die.
This horrifying picture of this one guy from like the 1930s who was like a pretty famous goalie at the time. And he just like, he looks like Frankenstein. He just has like stitches and like broken bones, and they would break their orbital bones, they said a lot. So
that's horrifying.
Yeah. So post all of that gloriousness in 1959, Plante retired in 1965, had a brief comeback from 67 to 75, and then finally retired in 1975 when his son passed away, sadly.
Oh, sad.
After he retired in 75, he moved to Switzerland with his second wife, who was Swiss. And he lived there until 1986, when he died. And this is the sweetest thing. When he passed away, there was a visiting team of like young hockey players from Quebec who were in Switzerland to play a tournament. And so when they carried his casket out of the church into the graveyard, they carried it under an arch of, like, hockey sticks that all the young men, like, held up.
That's so nice.
I know. And because it was just, like, this really kismet moment of, like, these young players being there. And so, yeah, he's generally considered to be one of the greatest goaltenders of all time. And in like the early 90s, like they did this like NHL like fantasy draft of like who would play on your team of like all time, and he was selected to be the goalie for that. So
obviously
I know, because he's the best,
the best,
and also Canadian.
I mean, he's no George Klein, but he's okay, I guess.
But Canada has some pretty sweet inventors, and now you know.
And now you know.
The more you know, right,
that's,
Sally?
You can't, that's someone else's slogan already.
The more you learn about that's Canada.
Terrible.
The more you know about Canada.
I hate it. We'll keep working on it.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye, Jacques Plante forever.